From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the first work week of the sequester. Big cuts are here, and the country's still figuring out where and how hard they'll hit. I don't think quite anyone understands how the sequester is really going to work, said Speaker of the House John Boehner this weekend. And whether a new deal can be reached is far from clear, with lawmakers on both sides still fighting over how the standoff is framed. This hour on Point, the sequester's impact and what happens next. You can join the conversation. Are you bracing for a furlough, a layoff? Are you concerned about how these cuts will affect your local economy? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later this hour, we're going to be speaking about the politics and the future of the sequester with guests Byron York and Chuck Babington. But first, the sequester's impact. Joining me from Jacksonville, Florida, is Chris Imbach. He's president and CEO of CTI Resource Management Services, a defense contractor based in Jacksonville that provides customer support, information technology, and human resources services. He learned 2 weeks ago that his company's largest Navy contract would be scaled back and has since had to lay off 39 employees. Chris Imbach, welcome to On Point.
Yes, Jane.
Well, what was your initial impact, your initial reaction when you heard about this 2 weeks ago?
Well, just before that, we were told we were mission critical. It wasn't going to be that big of a deal. As it drew closer, we were given notification that some of our functions and some of our services that we provide to the Navy were going to be reduced. And it was almost a daily thing that more things were cut and more things were cut. And by Thursday last week, we had 36 people actually that became unemployed.
So day by day, this news is getting worse. I guess then somewhere back in your mind, you weren't thinking this is not going to happen. You know, they're going to get it together in Washington.
I kind of thought they would get it together, and that I figured there might be some impact, but not as large as actually happened.
Mm-hmm. So 36 employees laid off so far. A lot of these folks have been with you for a long time, haven't they? How are they doing?
They are great people. And the thing that bothers me the most is these are some hard-working, middle-class, loyal people who have given the taxpayer 100% for many, many years. Some of the folks that we had to lay off have been with me since I founded the company in 2003. Mm. I love these people. They're great folks, and it was just really, really a tough day last week.
So you operate in 20 states, Chris. Tell us exactly what kind of work your company does.
Well, most of the contracts that we have outside of the state of Florida, Department of Homeland Security contracts, where we provide administrative support services. We have a couple defense contracts, both of them actually here in Jacksonville. The one that was hit the worst was our a big Navy contract where we support all the Navy bases in the world.
And so are you waiting for the next shoe to drop then?
Don't know. Your guess is as good as mine what's going to happen next, but we are planning. We're having a lot of budget meetings. I got to make the right decisions, the smart decisions, to be able to maintain the 140 folks that I still have today. And again, we're going out, we just got to win some contracts.
Right. And so I guess the uncertainty about all this affects how you run your business day to day, still waiting and wondering what you're going to do next.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How can you describe your frustration level with Washington, with what's going on there?
Well, we pay our lawmakers to serve us. And the sequestration, as you know, wasn't really supposed to happen. So when it got to the deadline and our lawmakers couldn't play nice in the sandbox, it really affected people out here. Again, hardworking, middle-class folks now are out of jobs. And it's just extremely frustrating to come to one of my single moms and tell them that, hey, I'm sorry, tomorrow you're not going to be able to support your family and provide benefits for your children. It's really kind of a tough gig.
Well, we appreciate your time, Chris Imbach. Thanks for joining us, and good luck to you, to all those folks that are having a tough day today and onward. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Have a great day, Jane.
Chris Imbach is president and CEO of CTI Resource Management Services. We're going to turn to travel now, air travel, and we're joined by Ben Mutsava. He covers air travel and the airline industry for USA Today. Ben, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about hearing about furloughs of air traffic controllers, these serious long-term delays at major airports. How do you see the sequester affecting air travel?
Well, right, that's the $80 billion question, right, is how exactly is this going to play out? We've heard, of course, a lot of the I don't know if bluster is the right word, but we've certainly heard dire warnings from FAA officials, air traffic controllers, and a lot of people on the Democratic side saying about how bad things could be. Of course, Republicans are saying, no, it won't be that bad. But I think, you know, we're waiting to see exactly, I think we can agree something will happen. How bad will it be? And I think we've seen a number of times in the airline industry, it often doesn't take much to create if not a major problem, at least a very severe nuisance. So I think we're all waiting to see. I know it's an imprecise answer, but this is an unusual situation, to say the very least.
So whether major problem or nuisance, when will travelers begin to see the impact of all this?
Well, we've heard mostly that because of the advance notice required for government workers and change in their work status, that this isn't likely to happen until the end of the month or April. However, we've heard today that Janet Napolitano has said some lines have already started to increase in Los Angeles and Chicago. She was not, I think we're still waiting to get some of the specifics on that, but it sounds like it's because they're cutting back on overtime, so it's eliminating one of the areas that Customs and the TSA are able to use to help augment their staffs at busy times of the day. And it's, according to Janet Napolitano, is already creating some significant delays, mostly for customers, for passengers arriving into the United States on international flights. But I think in April is really, if you have travel plans, when to watch. I'm already kicking myself for booking a 58-minute layover in May. If this doesn't, in Atlanta, if this doesn't resolve itself, it could be a problem.
So help us understand who the federal workers are at airports across the country. As a traveler, what will it look like? What will be different?
Right. It's going to come down in a number of areas. The things that the average passenger will feel the biggest effect from is there will be a reduction in staffing through the furloughs in the screening agents, so your lines at security checkpoints could get longer, and customers coming back from international trips, customs officials will be hit by the same type of a situation. So lines at customs, which already can be very long at some airports, could become even longer. And at airports, what will happen is air traffic controllers will also be subject to these work reductions from the sequester. And at the busiest airports, that will reduce the number of flights that an airport can safely handle in an hour. So when they bring those capacity levels down at the biggest, busiest airports, it's going to create some backups as there's not a whole lot of slack in the systems at, say, O'Hare, at LAX, at San Francisco to accommodate the reduced capacities when air traffic controller staffing is down. So they're saying 90-minute average delays at places like Chicago and New York and San Francisco. We've heard a lot of officials liken it to a perpetually bad medium-sized snowstorm that's at every airport in the country every day of the month. So, that's what we have to look forward to, and that's not a very encouraging sign. If these predictions are right, that's, of course, the big argument is the opposition who is in favor of the cut says, no, this is being overstated for political gain. But I think we'll find out our answer in April when it happens or when
right.
It doesn't.
So is it your sense the Obama administration was hyping some of these predictions about how the sequester would hit this industry, or you think these predictions seem accurate?
Well, I think there's no question that the potential impact is being played up. That said, the potential impact that is being played up is very plausible. It's being played up, but I think any of us can see a scenario where these things come true or close to true, and I would argue in this situation that even if the predictions are only come about 70% in as bad as they had expected, we will definitely feel it for the people who travel regularly. We will definitely be waiting in longer lines just to get into the airport, to come back into the country, and we'll probably be sitting on our planes a little bit longer.
You talked about the big airports, Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco. What about those regional airports? Will they be affected as much?
They will, and that's another one of the big uncertainty areas of uncertainty. You have small airports where the staffing changes could possibly result in towers being unstaffed at off-peak hours. That's not considered to be a huge, it's not a non-starter as far as a safety risk comes into play, but it does require some changes in how aircraft must and pilots must communicate when they land. Right now, we've seen, the Washington Post talk to airport officials in Garden City, and there are no changes there yet, but they're worried that some of the regional jets that would come in at a time when a tower might be unstaffed come April or May might make the airline reconsider. You know, again, this is all hypothetical, but that's how this could play out. The airports won't close, but it does, you know, the air traffic control staffing situation does cause some legitimate concerns or at least some uncertainty.
Uncertainty. I mean, let's underscore that the safety issues here are not significant, but they are being questioned at least. So flying will be less safe or just slower. What do you think, Ben?
Well, you know, the FAA's had an outstanding track record over the past decade or so, two decades even, of really staying on top of safety. So I don't think, and I certainly would hope, that we're not going to compromise safety, but to do that with these reduced staffing levels, it will reduce the capacity at some airports, and it will put into place at some of the smaller airports new rules that will be required for when staffing is non-existent at the towers that do make flying a little more cumbersome from a logistical standpoint. So that's I don't think it will
be less safe,
but it will be slower.
New rules in a post-sequester world. Ben Metzebaugh, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Ben Metzebaugh covers air travel and the airline industry for USA Today. We're talking about the sequester this hour, its impact, and its future. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking today about the sequester, where the cuts will hit and what happens next. The sequester may have big impacts on the food industry, and to zero in on one example of that, we're joined today from Los Angeles by George Safrance, CEO of Rogers Poultry, their plant near downtown Los Angeles, processes 30 to 40,000 chickens a day. George Safrance, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, how often is there a food inspector, an FDA food inspector, at your plant?
Well, there's usually one every day. They can come and go as they please. We don't know when they're showing up. It could be first thing in the morning. It could be any time during the day.
So have you noticed anything different?
Not yet. They're still here every day.
So the USDA, I'm reading here, is looking at $2 billion in cuts from their budget. That's a furlough of about a third of their workers, including all food inspectors. If indeed they stop showing up, can any work be done at your plant without those inspectors present?
No, I cannot do a thing. When the product gets to me, if I'm going to do anything to it, whether it's open a box, trim it, marinate it, cut it up, whatever I can do, I cannot do unless I'm under federal inspection.
So you're essentially shut down then, George?
I'm essentially shut down.
So do you have any sense yet of the specifics of how the sequester will affect your operations?
Well, first of all, I will have some notice because federal inspectors will have to be given a 30-day notice if they're going to be furloughed. But that notice doesn't really help me because there's not much I can do about it. And as long as they keep some inspectors in the circuit, we will be able to operate. If they take down the whole department, then we won't.
So then how are you getting your information from the government?
I am just reading the papers like everybody else.
So you don't have a go-to person, you don't know, you don't have a phone number, you're just kind of sitting, waiting.
Well, we talk to our local inspectors, and believe it or not, they're as much in the dark as we are.
Really?
Yes, we talk to them every day, like, what are you hearing, what are they hearing, and they're more concerned, and in all rights, they should be, about their own jobs than mine.
So how do you view lawmakers in Washington, George, after you've watched everything that's gone on over the last few days and weeks? What's your level of frustration at the process here?
Well, I'm disappointed. I mean, I've been around a long time, and in the old days, politicians would do the right thing in the end. I'm a little bit worried that might not be the case this time.
So how do you foresee making changes? I mean, if you do have to shut down, what's the long-term implication for you?
Well, it's death to our business, because if I can't produce product for my customers, I have to lay off 140 people. I can't get any product to my customer. They may switch away to something else. I'm not sure I can reopen. It's very catastrophic for me.
And as someone who's been doing this for a long time, George, what do you think about food safety here? How will this impact the broader food supply?
Well, the scary part of this is that in any industry, there's people who follow the rules and people that don't. If there are no inspectors, I'm shutting down because I have to. I'm assuming there will be some people out there will fly under the radar and still process product, and then it will be totally without supervision or inspection, and who knows what will be in the food chain at that point.
Mm. So fingers crossed, is that what you're doing there down in Los Angeles?
Pardon me?
Fingers crossed, hoping for the best here, but not quite sure, I guess.
Absolutely, day by day.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, sir. I appreciate you taking the time with us today, and to all your employees as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
George Safrans is the CEO of Rogers Poultry. Their plant near downtown L.A. processes about 30,000 to 40,000 chickens a day, feeling the real impact of this. We're going to go down to politics and the future of the sequester. We're joined by Charles Babington from Washington. He covers Congress for the Associated Press. Chuck, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, The Untold Story of the Democrats' Desperate Fight to Reclaim Power. Byron York, welcome back to On Point as well.
Hi, good to be here.
So here we are in a post-sequester world, $85 billion in automatic across-the-board spending cuts enacted. Everyone said this sort of meat cleaver approach to cutting the budget would be so awful that Washington would have no choice but to act, and yet here we are. So I'll start with you, Chuck. How do you see this playing out?
Well, not the way people thought it would. As you correctly pointed, this whole idea of a sequester would be, it was that it would be so unpalatable to both parties that they would find an alternative, and of course we know that they did not. I think there were some miscalculations on both parts, but definitely it turned out that Democrats miscalculated, thinking that the cuts to the military spending would be so untasteful to the Republicans that they'd be willing to do some type of compromise that would include some new revenue increases, and they got it reversed, really, that the aversion to new taxes of really of any sort on the part of Republicans, and especially House Republicans, is such an overriding priority for them that it trumps everything else, including their concerns about spending cuts to the Pentagon.
So, Byron York, was this a sequestration, a miscalculation by the White House?
Well, yes, it was, but I think it was also something that Republicans came around to, if not liking, accepting as they looked at what it would actually mean. I mean, a lot of our conversation so far has been based on the idea that these cuts are bad, that people will suffer because of them. I listened with great interest to the defense contractor earlier on in the program. Now, I don't want to say anything about whether his business is really great, absolutely critical or not, because I don't know, but I do know that outside services contracting has exploded at the Pentagon. It has tripled in cost since 2000, and Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, tried to reduce it. And if you reduced the Department of Defense spending on service contracts by 15% over the next 10 years, you would still leave contract spending at where it was in 2007 when the United States was fighting in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Something is wrong in that kind of explosion of a spending, and perhaps sequestration is one way to address it.
Hmm. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, House Speaker John Boehner was asked by David Gregory about the sequester and what it will mean for the American economy.
Is this going to hurt the economy? Will it hurt economic recovery? Listen, I don't know whether it's going to hurt the economy or not. I don't think anyone quite understands how the sequester is really going to work.
And then on Saturday, in his weekly address, President Obama urged Congress to compromise and end sequestration.
These cuts are not smart. They'll hurt our economy and cost us jobs. And Congress can turn them off at any time, as soon as both sides are willing to compromise.
Both sides willing to compromise. Chuck Babington, how likely is that?
It seems unlikely, Jane. Again, the Republicans have really dug in on the revenue question, and you know, it's really difficult for the Democrats to get into, especially if you're talking about where you know the country really needs to address its long-term spending problems are in the entitlement program, Social Security, Medicare, which are not a part of this sequestration. But Democrats are not going to go anywhere near that unless they see some new revenue on the table. And this has been part of the conversation for, you know, at least 2 years now. And as of right now, neither of those things seems to be happening. And as your show is showing with these conversations, people are becoming more and more comfortable with the idea of these sequester cuts.
Right. Byron, York, that's really the bottom line. There's still no resolution on the real issues of entitlement. As Chuck says, the increasing cost of Medicare and Medicaid.
No, there's not. As a matter of fact, when lawmakers of both parties decide to agree something, they basically throw out the thing that's the real problem and address something that's not as big a problem. I certainly think there's a lot of discretionary spending that can be cut, but the whole idea of the sequester was to put entitlement spending, which we know will be the main drivers of the deficit in coming decades, put that off to the side and not touch it. So Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid all off the table as far as sequestration cuts. I would say one thing about John Boehner, who's had a terribly mixed message over the last few weeks. He wrote in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago that sequester, quote, threatens U.S. national security, thousands of jobs, and more. And you thought, well, gee, if this is so bad, why are you supporting it? And Republicans have not been able to agree amongst themselves whether sequestration is something terrible that we should do anything to avoid or whether it's really not such a bad idea after all.
Right. So, Chuck Babington, does it benefit the administration if the sequester is perceived as very severe, or does it benefit the GOP if it doesn't seem so bad?
Well, of course, anytime we talk about the administration benefiting from something bad happening to the American people, that's going to cause a lot of knitted brows. But if the president has sounded some alarms and may have overdone it, especially because the sequester impacts will be slow in coming, at least in something visible. As you suggested earlier, the biggest negative impact might be just by dragging down the economy by the anti-stimulative effect of these big cuts. And if that happens, then there'll be a big political blame game. It might be difficult to for people to decide who is to blame because there are many, many factors when the economy goes up or down.
Well, the phone lines are packed here, gentlemen. Let's get some listeners in. First, Ray, he's calling from Enfield, Connecticut. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I think both sides are to blame, and, I'm not one to think that the government is a jobs program, but although the actual impacts of the cuts remain to be seen, I'm just appalled that the political yo-yo has wasted so much human capital and caused so much drama and impacted daily life like this. So it's no wonder why we're the butt of jokes worldwide. I think we can't settle our own economic problems at home.
Do you see this getting any better, or do you in fact see it perhaps getting worse?
Well, as all things, I think it's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better, but it's I don't know what better is going to be. I think this is a new normal, and I don't like it.
Ray, thanks very much for your call. I appreciate it. Let us go to Sam. He's in Beaufort, South Carolina. Sam, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
I'd like to comment on the sequester cuts. We're seeing something on the military bases all the way up and down the East Coast. There's something called furloughing civilian employees right now, which what basically they're going to do is all civilian employees, everything from maintenance personnel to administrative to instructors across the military board, especially in the Marine Corps, are going to be asked not to come in one day out of the week, out of the five-day work week. And so they can cut 20% of the expenditure that they spend on paying them.
And how will that impact what you do there?
It will impact significantly, Jane, because right now we're working with the minimal amount of civilians that we need to keep the military active duty force moving. So what I'm saying is that although they're going to cut these thousands and thousands of personnel's pay, that's not going to shorten their work by any means. All that's going to happen is all the work that builds up when they're not there is going to be there meeting them the day they get back.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what the government's doing is a solution to this is asking people to do the same amount of work for 20% less pay and therefore hindering the active duty military force from its mission.
Mm-hmm.
Already they're talking about mothballing or shelving Marine expeditionary units that provide the influence of national security around the world. So, where do I think this is going? I mean, I'm not a doom and gloom kind of guy, but we're definitely going to take a step down from from having any influence on the world stage as far as security.
Mm. Sam, thank you very much for your call. Byron York, Chuck Babington, there's an active duty Marine Corps member talking about the real impact on the ground. Byron, you first, your response.
Well, first of all, I'll go back to the defense spending. Somehow, the base budget for the Pentagon in 2007 was $431 billion. That does not include the cost of war fighting, Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq at that time, $132 billion. But anyway, that was a $431 billion base budget for the Pentagon. Now, it was estimated at $550 billion before sequestration cut. Now, you have to ask, why is our defense budget so much larger than it was at a time we were fighting a couple of wars? Should we actually begin to cut back? And yes, cutting back does have human cost, but the alternative is a defense budget in particular that continues to grow whether we're fighting a war or not.
Chuck Babington?
Part of the mixed message that Byron was talking about earlier is this confusion, I think, of if you think we need to cut spending, well, shouldn't we then see the impact of a smaller government and less spending? You know, we don't wish any individual person unhappiness, but you know, you can't have cuts without consequences. And where do you're part of these cuts, consequences you're seeing, Sam was just talking about it, military bases. You can't have it both ways. And if we as a society think we need to downsize government, then we've got to live with that. And going one step further to the earlier caller who talked about, you know, both parties being to blame, you know, I would also say the American people, you know, need to look at themselves, because in poll after poll, they say, oh, yeah, I want less spending. I want taxes to stay down, but don't touch Social Security or Medicare or these other programs I like. And we as a society really have not confronted the fact that we want a relatively high level of services and a relatively low level of taxation.
Quick point before we go to break here, Byron and Chuck, we've been hearing all the ways that this budget battle could have a negative impact on the economy, and yet the markets haven't flinched. In fact, the Dow is flirting with a record high. How do you explain that, Byron York?
Well, first of all, corporate profits have been doing quite well in recent months. They haven't been creating jobs, but they've done pretty good for corporate profits, so that's good for the stock market. The other thing is, I think the markets have begun to just discount a little bit of the back and forth that goes on in Washington. We've had various debt ceiling battles where it seemed like there was going to be some huge explosion and the world would end, and the markets reacted. And I think now they're just kind of thinking, the people who sort of make up the market are thinking, well, we'll just wait and see how Washington gets itself together, but we're not going to get overly excited about any single development.
Do you agree, Chuck? The market sort of discounting this back and forth, maybe a little political theater?
I do. I think the exception would be if we actually did break through the debt ceiling barrier, that is, when it's time to raise the debt ceiling so the government can continue to pay you know, encumbrances that is incurred. If we were to risk the full faith and credit of the government, that, I think, would have a very severe reaction in the markets. But we've not done that. I think both parties are leery of doing that.
How long do you think these cuts imposed by the sequester will last? Chuck?
I think they're going to last at least through the end of this fiscal year, which is September 30. Then we'll have a new fiscal year to look at. There just doesn't seem to be, barring something that really bad happening in the near future, there doesn't seem to be momentum to change them. People are sort of tired, and I think, as Byron pointed out earlier, Republicans especially have come around to say, you know what, these cuts aren't so bad after all.
Byron, you agree with that end date?
Not an end date of 1 year. I think they'll last quite a lot longer than that. Part of the problem with the cuts is that since they put them off a couple of months, they're all being stuffed into 7 months, but to be done by the end of September 30th, the end of this fiscal year. For the next year, they'll have a whole year, and they will be less pronounced. So my sense is they might last for 10 years.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the sequester this hour, the politics, the standoff, and what happens next. We're joined this hour by Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Inquirer, Examiner, and by Chuck Babington. He covers Congress for the Associated Press. Lots of listener input online here. One listener says, this series of cliffs, waterfalls, and Armageddons seems like scripted theater to me. I feel like they know what's going on, and I haven't a clue. Here's another one. Doesn't the sequester do exactly what the Republican base has been calling for, and really on a pretty small scale relative to what I hear all the time? So why aren't Republicans in Congress celebrating this as a victory? Let's go to John. He's got another thought in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, John. Welcome.
Hi, Gene. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I just, well, the last post that you just described pretty much hit the nail on the head as far as I can see. I think this is definitely a victory for the Republican House caucus. It's almost an Uncle Remus moment. You know, don't throw me in the briar patch, and here we are in the briar patch, and I think that's exactly where they wanted us to be. A cut is a cut, whether it's good or bad. Now, as far as putting some of this money back, I think you're going to get into a situation where a Head Start program or some other program for the poor is going to have to go up against a shiny new airplane, and I can pretty much tell you how Congress is going to vote on that kind of thing. So, you know, as far as what cuts come back, I think your panel can probably give us a pretty good idea of that, and I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, John. Byron, you first.
Well, these cuts actually disproportionately affect defense spending. They don't touch entitlement spending at all, and amongst the discretionary spending that they do cover, that about half of it comes from defense, and nowhere near half of discretionary spending is spent on the Defense Department. On the other hand, this is a big deal for Republicans for two reasons. One, anytime they've seen so-called cuts in the past, they suspected that they were phony cuts, that somebody in the executive branch, you know, cut some money they had planned to maybe spend 10 years from now, and then they call it a cut, so it's all phony. The second thing is that the sequester does preserve the spending priorities that the government has already come to. For better or worse, Congress has decided over the years to spend, you know, X percent of our money on defense, X percent on agriculture, X percent on education, etc. Well, sequestration, by cutting everything the exact same amount, keeps those priorities all the same. So Republicans have come around to think that given today's situation, perhaps that is the best possible way to cut.
Chuck, but do we see a fundamentally altered Republican Party, to your mind, that will stand strong against new taxes, even at the cost of big cuts to defense?
We've already seen that. We see that party in place now, and especially in the House, and this is not entirely due to the rise of the Tea Party. The anti-tax solidarity in the Republican Party has been growing and growing for years, but it's very strongly in place now. And I think that Republicans are somewhat slowly coming around to the notion that maybe they should be celebrating the sequester and taking credit for it instead of shying away from it. They are worried that, you know, possibility that President Obama might be right in that when ordinary Americans see the real impact of it, be it at the airport or wherever, that they won't like it. And, of course, the other possibility is that it does trigger a recession that the Republicans might or might not be blamed for. But I think all in all, they are coming around to the notion that, you know, maybe we have pulled one off on the president, and we should be proud of that.
Let's talk about where this crisis goes next. You both know the next looming battleground is the spending bill to fund the government for the rest of the year. The deadline for that is March 27th. The president and Speaker Boehner have pledged not to let the government shut down. But how do you see both sides staking their claims on this point? I mean, how do these next budget issues resolve themselves?
Well, March 27 was thought to be the next big fight, but I think the president seemed to kind of wave the white flag in his news conference on Friday, saying if the budget that they or the continuing resolution that they come up with keeps the spending at these sequestration levels, and he'll sign it. And neither side really wants a showdown and government shutdown in that case. So I think that the March 27th cliff, showdown, apocalypse, is not going to be that big a deal.
Chuck?
I think Byron is right. I think there's some weariness on part of both parties. They're sort of catching their breath. I'm going to give a little time for this sequester to start taking effect, and especially from the administration standpoint, there are other things, especially immigration and gun control, that they would like to address or need to address, and that's going to take some time and energy. So this might just kind of give them a little bit of a breather on the deficit spending issue that has just so dominated our politics for the last few years, and I think they'll try to turn at least somewhat more attention to those other things.
Back to the phones. Let's go to Amy. She's in Lovingston, Virginia. Amy, welcome to the program. Hello. Thanks for waiting.
Hello. Yes. I grow animals for meat, and I had a ready market for fresh lamb, which the sequestration has caused a mad panic at my packer. I'm not allowed by law to sell my meat unless it's inspected. And now I can't get a date until the middle of April, so I've lost that market for Easter.
Mm. And so what's the feeling around there, Amy? I mean, how are your employees feeling? How are you generally getting along?
Well, at the, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen. We don't know whether to order more, you know, whether to go buy more stock. We don't know whether to, you know, should we breed animals to get more? If we can't inspect them, we can't sell them.
Mm-hmm. And your thoughts about what's going on in Washington then, Amy, as it's directly affecting you and impacting your business?
I think they're being stupid. And every time I turn on the radio, all they say is, oh, all this is going to affect is fat cat federal employees. I don't work for the federal government. This is affecting ordinary, everyday people.
Amy,
and they need to just get off their butts and work.
Amy, thanks so much. Byron York, would you respond to that? I know many Americans sort of feel this sense of what's going on back there, right?
Well, a couple of things. One, I don't know the particulars of Amy's situation. It has been understood here that as far as furloughs are concerned, and for federal employees like meat inspectors, they have to give a 30 or even a 60-day notice for furloughs. So it would not seem that it would be possible that anybody would be furloughed right now. On the other hand, we are going to have to see what actually happens with these sequestration cuts, and it's all going to depend on the good faith of the executive branch. Do they want to do cuts in such a way that are most rational and do not affect or affect a minimum number of people, or do they want to do these kind of world-ending cuts to make a political point against Republicans? It's going to be very important to see what they do on that.
Chuck?
Well, we're seeing there are uneven results or impacts of this sequester. You know, when the private sector has all kinds of ups and downs, and over the years you see some industries thrive and others contract, and you'll see headlines that say, you know, a certain company has laid off thousands of people, and of course in each individual case that's very bad or maybe even tragic, but we look at that as, well, that's part of the free market capitalist system for good and for bad. When it's an effect from our government, so that Amy, you know, it has an disproportionate impact of what's happening. We see it in somewhat different light because we think, well, the government is supposed to be, you know, treat its citizens equally. That doesn't happen because, in a way, the government is a gigantic business as well. But we see that in a light that's different from the way we see it through the private corporation lens.
It feels to many like we're living from cliff to cliff, you know, all these multiple deadlines, the sequester, the budget battle, the next round of the debt ceiling fight that's coming up early, late spring, early summer. I've actually heard some congressional leaders talking about ways to bring these together. I mean, could you put a couple of these deadlines together so that we do have a larger deal? I mean, does that seem like something that's plausible? Byron York?
A big deal is still actually plausible in the sense that obviously it has to go after entitlement spending to reduce the rate of growth of entitlement spending. The president has said he wants to go for these closing loopholes and perhaps extending the tax base, broadening the tax base. And Republicans have wanted to go after these entitlement cuts. Now, Republicans have expressed some support in the past for ending the loopholes and broadening the base, and the president has expressed some support in the past for some entitlement reform. So it's not impossible that there would be a deal, but some of these deadlines are just legal things. I mean, Congress extended the Bush tax cuts for a couple of years to expire on January 1 of this year. So something had to be done before January 1. You know, the debt limit does get hit at some point. It was going to get hit in February. And so they extended the limit. I mean, sequestration, they signed a bill and a law in 2011 saying that would start on January 1, 2013. So there's some of these actual legal deadlines that it seems like we're fighting a lot these days, but they're actual legal deadlines that have to be addressed.
Chuck Babington?
we've seen really a dramatic changes in the partisanship of Congress, the realignment of the parties, the redistricting that includes gerrymandering, but is not solely because of gerrymandering. And so in so many cases, you have House districts that are just very, very liberal or very, very conservative. And in the conservative cases, you know, the Republicans have the House majority, you have so many Republican members who cannot possibly lose a general election. There's no way their district would vote for a Democrat. But the only way they can lose office is by being defeated in the Republican primary by an even more conservative challenger. I talk with Republicans every week, and I hear this over and over. That's their biggest concern. And even though they might, in their heart of hearts, think that a grand bargain, which would have a balance of some revenue increases and some changes to the entitlement programs, even if they think that might be a good idea, they fear that if they go on the record as supporting something with any revenue increases at all whatsoever, that they'll be vulnerable in the next primary. And that's a real problem in Congress. You hear this over and over, and it's quite a few members that feel this way.
Let's go back to the phones now to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ellen is on the line. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
May I point out two things that the Republicans have refused to allow the richest in the country to be taxed at a higher level, so they are unlikely to be affected by the sequester. There's another group, and that's members of Congress. Their salaries are unaffected by the sequester, which is not true of so many other people's incomes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what's your reaction to that, Ellen? What do you think about that?
Completely disgusted.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, I appreciate your call. Thank you. Byron York?
Well, I'd have two reactions. One, on her second point about Republicans, about Congress and its salaries being affected, I would agree they should be affected by the sequester to the degree that other federal spending is affected by the sequester. As far as Republicans refusing to allow the richest in the country to be taxed at a higher level, I mean, we had an election about that and a big fight about that in November and December, and taxes on the highest bracket did, in fact, go up. Republicans opposed it, but they lost.
Chuck Babington?
Members of Congress care about their salaries, I'm sure, but they care a lot more about getting reelected. That is the overriding concern for the vast majority of members of Congress in both parties, and that is what drives so much of what happens in Congress. It's not their salary. They're not concerned about their salary all that much. They're concerned about getting reelected. Again, this severe partisanship that we see that makes it so hard to get things done, really that's the root of it. That's where you have to look at the beginning of what motivates people in Congress.
So there's motivation then to get reelected. I mean, I guess the big overriding political question is, are both sides basically setting up for the midterm race, and that, you know, some of these budget issues cannot be resolved because we have another election coming? Byron York?
Well, that's what we said the last time. I mean, there were all these various standoffs that were going to be resolved by the 2012 election. And so, actually, I think that with sequester, for example, we'll see in coming months. I mean, it's just only been a couple of days. We'll see in coming months, is this something that is really bad, people don't like it, Republicans give in? Or is it something that's actually okay and Democrats will give in? I mean, I think actual conditions will begin to dictate what happens on that spending issue.
Let's go to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Gene is on the line. Hi, Gene. Welcome to On Point.
Raise additional taxes.
Can you say it again, Gene? We need to hear you.
Oh, I said that basically I think that these are all discretionary cuts. And at the end of the day, you'd have never gotten these cuts, especially the defense cuts, if it didn't occur this way. And it gives the Democrats cover because it's been strictly a Republican push in this direction. And I think that, when you stop to consider, now they will debate over what to add, whether it's Head Start or whether it's increased revenues on whoever. We're basically starting from zero, but,
Gene, you see this as a win for Democrats?
I don't see it as a win, but I don't see it as a loss. I think it's a win-win for the country, with the exception of the people like the lady who's dependent on meat inspectors and people who are going to be laid off. But they'd have been laid off anyway, if you stop to think about it, if the actual cuts that we needed to take in defense and these discretionary areas took place anyway.
Chuck. Gene,
I appreciate your call. Thanks. Thanks very much. We've got about a minute left, Byron York and Chuck Babington. I mean, so here we sit in a post sequester world, $85 billion in these cuts across the board enacted. Give us a sense of where we're going to go from here. Chuck Babington, you first.
I think we're going to settle in for several months now. I think Byron's right. We'll probably get through the next continuing resolution to keep the government funded without too much drama, probably take care of the next debt ceiling increase. We will have to see how the public reacts to these sequester cuts. But in a way, they might be the new normal. And the big question is whether we'll ever get to a grand bargain that would include some changes to entitlement reform. That would have to include some new revenues on the table.
Byron York, final words.
I think you saw in the president's news conference on Friday that he was worried that continuous fighting over fiscal issues would basically squeeze out any chance that he had to do what he wants to do on immigration reform, on climate change, on gun control. And I think you're going to see the White House push some of those things. These fiscal issues are going to be with us. They're not going to go away. They have to pass a budget this year, for example. But I think the president's going to try to start emphasizing some other parts of his agenda.
Well, the new normal, here we go. Byron York, thank you very much for your time today. Chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Thanks for your time, Byron.
Thank you, Jane.
And Chuck Babington, thanks so much to you. Chuck Babington covers Congress for the Associated Press. Chuck, thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
And listeners, thank you. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow on Point, more refugees pouring out of Syria, more promises of aid for the rebels, and more fears that the radicals will win this fight. We'll take stock of that. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.